Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. We're back on the economy again today, and delighted to have Jack Rasmus on. Jack knows the issue so well. His articles are tremendous. I literally devour them when they come out. He's got two important books, one that came out 2010, I think. Jack can correct me when he comes on, called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. He's got a brand new one coming out any day now, I believe the first week in April. And he calls it Obama's Economy, Recovering for the Few. And I think last time Jack was on, I suggested adding one word to the title, Recovery for the Very Few. It certainly isn't for most people who need it, and the people who are the richest, literally raping the system for profits at the expense of everybody else, they will get more of it if things turn out their way. Well, let's hope that they don't. Jack, oh, I can hardly wait for your book to come out. I sent you my article that I included, a short write-up of your book based on the information that you sent, and I certainly hope a lot of people buy and read it.
Well, thank you. Yes, you can pre-order it on Amazon, I believe.
Oh, indeed. Absolutely.
Two weeks in the bookstores, I think, about the middle of April.
Amazon works great, Jack. I remember it with my own weeks, even months before the, well, not too many months, but well in advance of a book coming out. When you know it's a good one, when you know you want to read it, pre-order it, and you will get it like clockwork when it comes out.
You can also order it even more promptly from my own website, Kyklos Productions. That's KYKLOS Productions.com. Or just Google me and you'll see my website, Kyklos.
Oh, sure. That's an easy way. Jack Rasmus, R-A-S-M-U-S. Google Jack Rasmus. You'll find out information about him, his book, how to order it. Oh, absolutely do it, Jack. I go to your site, and I'm on your mailing list to get your articles, so I don't need to check the site for new ones, but I hope you'll keep sending me your articles.
I'm selling it less than Amazon on my website, so that's the cheapest place you can get it.
They do offer discounts, right?
Yep.
Well, but, I recommend
maybe next month when it's out, we can talk about the main arguments of the book. Which, just to briefly summarize, are that we are stuck in a stop-go, relatively stagnant recovery that can go on for years. Stop-go means we get shallow, short recoveries that don't last, and we relapse back down to virtual no growth, and we get another inadequate stimulus and another short, shallow growth. We bump along the bottom like that and can for quite some time. Now, where we are right now in that kind of scenario is we got a little brief recovery of sorts, very mixed. Each recovery is getting weaker and weaker, and more of it is accruing to the very wealthy. As people may have heard, last year 93% of whatever income was gained in the economy, in other words, GDP, the income gained, national income, 93% went to the wealthiest 1% household. That's unprecedented. You know, it's been growing over the last few decades. Every year, more and more accrues to the very top. And now we've got this incredible situation of 93% of all the gains. In the previous decade, it was like 68% of all the gains went to the wealthiest 1%. And then in the 90s, it was like 60%. So it's going up every decade, but boy, it's escalating really fast now. And real incomes in terms of wages continue to go down while corporate profits continue to go up. The figures just came out a few days ago. The real income gains and wage gains, are the lowest since 1953, and corporate profits gains are the highest since 1968. So that's the nature of this recovery. And whatever you're getting in terms of GDP growth is skewed to the high end, and to the extent that the bottom 90% households over 100 million are participating in consumption, Now it's very clear that it's once again consumption not based on income gains, but consumption based on credit and debt. And most of that is auto debt and student debt right now. To what extent we got consumption growth and are getting consumption growth, it's this big push on autos and auto loans that shows up as, household debt, auto loans and student loans. Student loans now are over $1 trillion accumulated, going up. And auto loans, auto companies have not really totally recovered, and they are desperate to keep the momentum going, so they're offering these incredible deals in terms of financing in order to keep the production lines going. And that's where most of the consumption is going. You look at the fourth quarter GDP last year, it's that consumption criterion. The wealthiest 10% households are buying because stock prices are escalating, and they buy mostly on which way the stock market's going, because that's where they make most of their income. The bottom 90% on credit, buying automobiles, mostly in paying for student loans. And then you have some business spending increased in the fourth quarter that was virtually all inventories. Now, all of those three cannot continue. The inventories will not play as much role in this first quarter of 2012. We're going to see a decline in GDP in this first quarter. I don't know how long people can go on buying automobiles at those levels of discount and not those levels of credit. And business spending is stabilizing. In other words, slowing down because of the inventory buildup has already occurred. And then we have these wild cards. My next article coming out is Hipsters, Jokesters, and the 2012 Recovery. And what we've got in addition to that picture I just described in the U.S. is rapidly rising gas prices that are going to start to take an effect here in the spring, because gas prices will continue to rise. We're already at $4 a gallon on average. We've seen gas prices rise 40-50% in a month out here in California. 40-50 cents, excuse me, a month out here in California. But we're going to see gas prices continue to rise, and they could rise very fast if the situation in Iran destabilizes quickly. So that's a wild card, the gas prices. I would also say another wild card that people aren't aware of yet is what's going to happen with healthcare prices. Healthcare prices are quietly already rising significantly. A family of four today, according to studies, pays over $20,000 for health care premiums and out-of-pockets and so on and so forth. That's more than double what it was 10 years ago. Yeah, $20,000, believe it or not, in premiums and so forth.
Jack,
and that is so outrageous, and they are debating at the Supreme Court this question of whether to kill Obamacare in the mandate. And unlike most experts, I think they will kill the mandate. And what that's going to mean is already healthcare prices have been rising significantly since the so-called Obamacare Act was passed. Its great failure is the failure to control prices. But wait until the Supreme Court decision comes down, and if they eliminate that mandate, you're going to see an even faster escalation of healthcare costs and prices.
Yeah, you really will. The idea that everybody needs health care, Jack, means that the insurers to get prescription drugs, you need special coverage for that. It's not automatically in an insurance program. I don't have prescription drug coverage, and I'm on Medicare, but I refuse the Part D because it's a ripoff. But if you take away that income coming in from these ripped-off consumers that don't have a choice, and if they opt out, they're taxed, so they get hit no matter what they do. That means it's open season for the insurers and the drug companies, as you say, to hike prices even more.
Yes, and that includes drug prices, of course, but it also includes the rest of health care. Watch the prices go up. It's going to be amazing how fast health care costs escalate here if they shoot down that mandate, and I think they will. And legally, if they shoot down the mandate, it brings into question the rest of the bill in certain areas, you know, that were relative progressive, you know, like ensuring pre-existing conditions and so forth. All that's going to be up for grabs. It's going to unravel if they shoot down the mandate. Now, we would even have this issue if Obama hadn't pulled public option off the table. You see, he shot himself in the foot here with his health care bill when he pulled the public option off of the table. And now you got a solution that looks like it may come apart here. Now, there's a couple of other wild cards besides gas prices and health care prices.
Yeah, could I throw in one thing before you get on to that? To explain the difference between buying health care today and when I first went to work as a newly minted MBA over 50 years ago, in the interim, before I took my job, I bought a short-term, I bought a one-year health plan that I thought covered me especially against anything catastrophic. Medical insurance policy in 1959. It cost me $100 and change for the entire year. $100 and change. Even as a starving grad student, Jack, I could afford that. And today, does an individual get into double digits buying a comprehensive health insurance plan?
If they buy a decent preferred provider plan, yes.
I mean, I can't even calculate the percentage increase from $100, say, to $10,000.
Yeah.
I mean,
why we have these escalating prices? You got to go back to the Clinton administration. You know, I mean, we didn't start getting these skyrocketing health care prices until Clinton. And the whole solution during the Clinton years was managed health care, which meant, okay, let's get people to self-ration their use of health care. And to get the managed health care passed, Clinton and others agreed to allow the for-profit chain hospitals and insurance companies exemption from antitrust, which meant they could go out and buy each other up. That was the quid pro quo. And buying each other up meant they had to get big loans, to buy their competitors. Well, where did they get the loans? They got the loans from Wall Street. What were the conditions of Wall Street? Wall Street said, okay, instead of making 5-7 cents on the dollar, before we give you this loan to buy your competitor to raise your prices, you've got to get 20-22% on the dollar. So the Clinton administration set this thing in motion, this escalation. By exempting from antitrust, so all of these insurance companies fix their prices essentially with each other, and because they can't be sued under antitrust, and we get this escalating prices ever since the mid 1990s on the health insurance side, and then the private for profit hospitals say, okay, let's buy up each other, and they drive it up. And then the doctors look around and they say, well, gee, you know, the health insurance companies and the profit and the hospitals are making these big bucks. Let's raise our prices, too. And then we get the drug companies, and you pass the Part D in 2005. You don't fund it, and you say that states and companies and the government cannot negotiate bulk prices. In other words, let the drug companies raise whatever they want. So this whole Part D is really just an income pass-through to the drug companies. They can charge whatever they want, and they do charge pretty much whatever they want, and the taxpayer has to pay for it because there was no funding, no tax passed with Part D, you know, the prescription drug bill, and it's costing $400-500 billion. It's just a big subsidy to the prescription drug companies. And the same thing is going on now with the mandate. The mandate is really a subsidy to the big health insurance companies. The solutions are totally non-solution. to the healthcare crisis. You know, the simplest solution to the healthcare crisis is Medicare for all. That's it.
Oh, absolutely.
And it would be cheaper. It would be cheaper than any other solution. I mean, look, 45 million people are covered decently under Medicare for a 2.9% tax. Now, $20,000 is the cost, we've said a minute ago, for health insurance, private health insurance coverage per family, right? $20,000. What percent of their income is that, their household income? Well, it's 30 to 40%. You know, $47,000, $48,000 is about the median. So $20,000, you know, it's about 40% of $47,000, $48,000, $50,000. You want to pay 40% or you want to pay 3%? I mean, but they won't even discuss that. They don't even allow it in the deficits and the debates, you know, on cutting the deficit. No, neither side, Democrat, Republican, will even talk about Medicare for all. They exclude it from any debates and in any discussion. You don't see articles about it in the corporate media. It's really the simplest and cheapest solution, but no one even wants to talk about it because that means the insurance companies are out, you know, out of the picture.
Well, nobody goes to an insurer for a checkup, or if they're ill, Jack, and they need treatment, or if they need surgery. There is no insurance agent that can do that for you.
No, here's another picture. You know, we spend $2.6 trillion of our GDP every year on health care, about 17%. Nobody in the world comes even close to paying that. I mean, every year,
right,
pays about 10% for health care. We pay 17%, $2.6 trillion. A trillion of that goes to paper pushers. In other words, it doesn't even go to those who deliver health care services, hospitals, doctors, whatever. It goes to the insurance companies. They don't deliver health care. They just move paper around and suck off profits off the top.
That's
you know,
exactly
we're paying $1 trillion for middlemen and paper pushers. It's unsustainable.
It's like paying off a loan shark, Jack. You know, instead of going to the bank and paying whatever rate of interest, you go to your neighborhood loan shark and they charge you five times as much. And if you don't pay in time, they break your leg or something like that. I mean, that's what these people are, leeches. They don't provide any service. They literally stick their hand in our pocket and steal what we have. And that's the kind of system that we have. During the health care debate, Jack, that went on so many months, I wrote enough, literally to fill a book. It literally could have filled a book, and there's absolutely no question the only solution that works, there is no other one, it's health care for all. You can call it Medicare for all, but it's universal health care. Everybody in, nobody out. Everybody's got the same system. Nobody gets plan A, somebody else plan C or D or E. Everybody's on the same system, from Obama down to the lowliest stumble bum. Every U.S. citizen is covered, and nobody is left out. Well, I may have to be reincarnated two or three times before we ever see a system like that in the country. I'm thankful, Jack, that somehow Lyndon Johnson, who was a mean and nasty president you didn't want to go up against in a debate, he would debate you with his nose right up against yours, and he was tall, and he was big, and he won every time. And because of him and his muscle and his influence, he got Medicare passed in 1965. As much as I dislike Lyndon Johnson, I sure as hell thank him for Medicare.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the situation in healthcare. And I'll go on record here predicting that the mandate will get trashed.
Oh, I think it will. I think absolutely. I think the fix is in right now.
It has nothing to do with the constitutional arguments, which is what they're jumping around on. You know,
they're talking about the Commerce Clause.
It's a political thing. It's a political thing. And that, you know, when you talk about Justice Roberts and Alito and Scalia and all, these are very political guys, and they're going to rule.
The Chamber of Commerce is on the get rid of this stuff side of the fence. And the Chamber of Commerce represents a business, I guess National Association of Manufacturers. They may be in there as well. I wrote about the Supreme Court debate. There is more money being poured into the amici briefs It exceeded the previous record amount of money spent, I think, on numbers and dollars spent on each brief by something like a third or 40%. And all the muscle, you know, the business muscle is lined up on the side of getting rid of all this stuff. And that's who these justices represent.
Yeah, and another good trend, if you watch closely what's happening, they're ramping up, once again, reintroducing and ramping up discussion on the budget deficit and cuts. That's going to intensify as a topic here once Romney and the Republican establishment clarify he is the candidate here. Paul Ryan put out his new budget here in Congress a few days ago, and it's really once again attacking Medicare, Medicaid, and protecting defense spending. Simpson and Bowles are back on the these were the two commission chairmen. Simpson and Bowles are back on the road here, pushing their $4 trillion of cuts. And as I predicted last fall, when the super committee kicked the can down the road in Congress and said, okay, we're not going to come to an agreement now because it's too close to the election year. Both sides concurred on that. I predicted and do predict now, for the record, that you will see an intensification of the debates on deficit spending, and as soon as the election is over in November, it doesn't matter who is elected, Obama or Romney, you're going to see a massive push to cut trillions of dollars more, trillions, another, $2 to $4 trillion at minimum, and that will be cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, primarily, so-called closing some loopholes, not major closing, token closing of loopholes, on a ratio of about 4 to 1. In other words, for every $1 of tax loophole closing, it will be $4 of cuts in spending. And now that will hit 2013. Those additional cuts, we've already passed $2.2 trillion in cuts, but the politicians backloaded it, meaning the cuts don't take effect until 2013. So we got $2.2 trillion starting to take effect in 2013. They're going to add another several trillion dollars in cuts immediately in November, December of this year, and all that's going to hit with a vengeance the U.S. economy. It's our version of austerity, just as what you see going on in Spain and Italy and other places in Europe, and it's going to converge. The European crisis is going to reemerge with a vengeance in 2013, I believe, maybe even before. On top of that, we have all these cuts coming in the U.S. Economy, and the so-called weak, short, shallow blip in the recovery in this election year will be followed by another downturn, I believe, in 2013.
It could be, it's bad enough already, Jack, on Main
Street.
Yeah,
we really don't have a recovery going on here. If you look at last year, what was GDP growth last year? 1.7% in the second year of recovery? That's about a third of what recoveries are 2 years after a recession in other recessions in the United States, about a third. That's why I say it's, chapter one of my book is leads off with saying the Obama economy, the weakest and most lopsided recovery in U.S. economic history. Lopsided meaning it's all accruing to the very wealthy. Stock market's up over 100%. Bond markets are up 150%. Wealthiest households, have fully recovered. Corporate profits are at record levels, as I just mentioned. Profit margins, the highest in 80 years. 80 years profit margins. And you go on and on. We just had a report last week, hedge fund managers making $3-4 billion, one guy, $3-4 billion, and paying 15% tax. Before their tax lawyers, by the way, go after the 15%. People making billions and paying less than 10% effective tax rate. And now they want to cut even Obama has proposed to cut corporate taxes. That, by the way, will be part of this debate at the year end. They are all in agreement to cut wealthy, the top right for wealthy individuals and the top right for corporations, which is now both 35%. They're going to cut them somewhere between 25 and 28%. Both sides are in agreement on doing that as part of this increased cuts in spending that's coming here in November, December, as a, you know, element of that. They're going to cut wealthy taxes even more as they go after Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, education, and so forth.
It's shocking, Jack, and the so-called stimulus, a few trillion in stimulus that Obama provided in Congress. The majority of it went to, in corporate tax cuts extended for the super rich. It didn't go into productive economic growth. It literally went into the pockets of the people who already have more than they need, and they keep getting more and more and more. Jack, I'm literally speechless watching and writing about this.
That's covered in my book as well. We've cut since 2009. About $1.6 trillion in taxes, mostly for wealthy and for corporations. What kind of job recovery did we get? Well, we have 25 million unemployed, effectively, U6 unemployment rate, the Labor Department, in 2009. We got about 23 million. So, and much of those are part-time temporary jobs. So where did all that tax cut money go is the question. Well, you know, it went offshore into their tax havens. It went to invest in speculative ventures, you know, through hedge funds and so forth, currencies, you know, Chinese property, Brazilian currencies, commodities. A lot of it goes out of the country, flows right out of the country to other investments abroad, or it's hoarded. Corporations are sitting on $2.5 trillion of cash, $2.5 trillion. Okay. And banks are sitting on over $1 trillion in excess reserves, and they're just hoarding it. They're not using it to spend, to lend in mom-and-pop business. Bank lending has gone up, but it's all gone to wealthy big corporations. They're not lending to mom-and-pop businesses, you know, to create jobs. And big corporations are sitting on their cash hoards and investing abroad or investing in speculative ventures. I point all this out. You know, where's all this money going? And Obama spends $1.5 trillion on what? Well, subsidies to the states for a while, unemployment and so forth. Very little of it goes towards real job creation. There's no job creation program in Obama's 3 years here. It's all relying on the private sector and corporations, which have not followed through. What about the housing? It's all voluntary. Let the banks let's provide incentives to the banks to lend to new home buyers. Nothing to save those facing foreclosure. You know, they're all agreed. Let those in foreclosure foreclose, and we're still we get 2 to 3 million foreclosures a year, and it's still continuing. And then Obama passes this bill or proposes this HARP here. You know, last month. What is HARP? Once again, it's an incentive to the banks. Please lower your rates and please lend to stimulate the housing market. Well, what are they doing with HARP? I'll tell you what's going on behind the scenes. HARP is supposed to allow people in negative equity up to 200% underwater, you know, if their loans are underwater, to refinance, okay, at lower rates. Now, it's going to cost about $26 to $30 billion, and the banks are willing and have signed up. The big banks, mortgage lenders, okay, we will lend now to those underwater. They wouldn't lend to those underwater before, in exchange for which, you know, government, states as well as federal, relieve us from any future legal liabilities over this robo-signing deal. So we're going to put up $26 billion, and we're going to somehow distribute that to about 2 million homeowners. Well, that's a pittance. That's a pittance compared to what they rip people off for. But even that's not working. I'll tell you why. What the banks are now doing, and this isn't getting it in the press, right? The banks are now doing, okay, we got to finance those who are in negative equity. So what they're doing is tightening their loans to people who aren't in negative equity. That's why home mortgage rates are rising and are going to continue to rise. They're cutting off the loans to normal borrowers in order to put money aside to fulfill this deal to refinance for a few of the, you know, the folks that are in negative equity, of which there are 10 to 15 million whose homes are underwater. So that $26 billion, you know, is hardly going to touch it. It's tokenism, and it doesn't solve the problem, because Obama's solutions in the last 3 years are not solutions about what are we going to do about those poor folks with negative equity and those in foreclosure. Let's just subsidize the banks some more so they'll loan to new people.
Jack, we need to take a break. Yeah, I agree with you. It's a sick, corrupted system. Talk about a plutocracy in spades. Let's take a break and we can come right back. Literally, I have a permanent lump in my throat and in my heart about the devastation done to so many millions, so a very elite few can get super rich and then super rich even more. We'll be right back. With Jack Rasmus. Jack's new book, again, coming out in early April, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. Let me mention mine, and I have a new one that is well along, and it'll come out when my editor-publisher decide they will get it out. But my current one, Jack, you cover the issue so well in your books and all of your writings, and you focus solely on the economy and related issues to it. I cover so much stuff, and I'm not an economist, but I sure wrote about Wall Street, and I called my book How Wall Street Fleeces America. And I'm doing a follow-up, Jack. My editor asked me to do it. I began working on it months ago, and unless the title is changed, it's called Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity. And I think what we talk about on this program, Jack, is exactly that. The predators wage financial war on humanity. They do it in this country politically, the political system in Washington, the big Wall Street giants, the Federal Reserve that they control. In Europe, they do it through the systems that they have set up, the Eurozone, the Bank of England in Britain. And literally, people get ripped off to make rich people a lot richer and big corporations a lot bigger. And a lot of their profits come right out of the hides of the people that they employ, or they sack, or they pay lower wages and fewer benefits. And it's amazing how productivity goes up, Jack, when you literally take it out of the hides of human beings who don't have what they need to get by, and the middle class is being destroyed in Europe, it's being destroyed in America. I guess we'll just have to admit what America is coming to at very, very fast speed. The worst of a banana republic, with the repression in there with all the rest, because when angry people resist, you just beat their brains in to cow them. And I'm afraid that's the situation we already have, and it's going to get an awful lot worse. I say it often, Jack, and I mean it. The worst is yet to come.
Well, yes, in 2013. Okay, we're going to stumble along here during an election year, but things will intensify. That's why I've always predicted in this stop-go economy that they call a recovery. 2013 is the next juncture, and that will find a convergence of developments, one of which is this new cutting, additional cutting. The old cutting is going to hit the economy. New cutting will be added to it. And then we have the situation in Europe and now in China. You know, if the U.S. thinks it can continue growing while the rest of the world is slowing down, entering a recession, that's nonsense. It's just not going to happen. Europe, of course, the southern tier is in the depression, meaning from Greece to Portugal, as a result of austerity programs. You can't cut your way out to recovery. It's just not that possible. And now we see the core economies slipping as well. Britain just entered a recession. The Netherlands entered recession. France just dipped below the stagnant point, no growth. And Germany is slowing down as well. Contrary to what they say, Germany cannot continue growing while the rest of Europe, to whom it exports its goods, stops buying its goods. There's just no way Germany can continue growing. It will be the strongest and the last to enter recession in Europe, but that will occur. And the European economy, the EU economy, is bigger than the U.S. economy when you add it all up together, 27 countries. So if that's in recession, you know, that's going to impact the U.S. in a whole number of ways, not just exports. And now we have China rapidly slowing down. And not just China, but the rest of the, quote, fastest-growing countries in the world are rapidly slowing down. China GDP will, I predict, fall below 6%. You know, it's been running 10, 12%. But within the next 12, 18 months, it will be less than 6%, which will be very, very low for China. India, growing 9 to 10% normally in recent years, is already down to 6%, will fall below 5%. Brazil, growing 8 to 10%, is now probably about 1% growth in Brazil. So the rest of the world and global trade and manufacturing is slowing down. At the heart of Obama's, quote, recovery is his focus on manufacturing. That's why he brings Jeff Immelt, GE, in to run the show. But there's no way manufacturing is going to lead the economy to recover in the United States. It's only 10% of the economy in the United States now because we move so much of it offshore. And even that 10% is going to slow down, and we see that in January with durable goods orders falling 4%, lowest since 2009. So all the signs, you know, are flashing that this recovery can, quote, recovery, skewed for the few, based on debt spending now, once again, and dissaving, cannot continue and will not continue in 2013 for a whole host of reasons. And that conforms to my picture of this as an epic recession, meaning stop-go, short, shallow recoveries, followed by dips in the economy, relapses, I call them, or double-dip recessions. And we can go on this way for quite some time. But the problem really points to you have to not only have more stimulus. You know, the liberals, Krugman and others are right. The stimulus was too small. But I, in difference to Krugman, and say, well, it's not just how much you spend, but what you spend it on and how fast you spend it. What's the timing and what's the composition of that? You know, in my book, Obama's Economy, I really criticize Obama, not only because he went with Larry Summers' suggestion that you can't spend more than $800 billion, and half of that has to be tax cuts for the rich, instead of other advisors who were saying you need $1.2, $1.4 trillion in 2009. I was saying 2009 you need $2 trillion. So he went with the bankers, i.e. Larry Summers' suggestions, and he got this very weak recovery that relapsed in 2010. They threw more money at it, tax cuts, and so forth, got even a weaker recovery. And we're in the third phase, third program here, where they're throwing some more money at it. And, of course, each time the Federal Reserve pumps hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy in QE, which just stimulates the stock market and commodity prices. And we were having repeats of this same approach, and it's not working three times here. But no one's willing to break out into a whole new approach of programs recovery. Now, in my book, Obama's Economy, the last chapter is about alternative programs for economic recovery. In other words, something totally different in terms of the approach to jobs, housing, and state and local governments, a total major restructuring of the tax system, of the retirement system, and of the banking system. All those three restructurings are absolutely necessary, and the new programs have to focus on jobs, housing, and local governments, which isn't happening here. So my program is significantly different than what Obama has introduced and what liberal economists are calling for. In the long run, you have to do something about expunging all this household consumer debt, getting rid of it, whether it's housing debt or student debt or whatever debt. And you have to do something about restructuring income in the United States, because you can't go on with 90% of the households with declining real income and expect any kind of recovery. Just won't happen.
But they're not planning anything, Jack, to do this, and I agree with you. It literally makes no difference whether Republicans or Democrats control the White House, control Congress. They're going to slash and burn, hammering ordinary people. They can do it this way or that way or some other way or a combination of ways. They can disagree on the ways they're going to do it. But the bottom line is ordinary people are going to be severely harmed. The rich are going to get richer than ever. And the serious problem we have today that affect the great majority of people in the country will only get worse from all the things that you've mentioned on this program, Jack. I know you talk about them in your book. You talk about them in your articles that you write. I cover some of this in articles that I write, and there are literally a devastating storm clouds out there that are just going to, if ordinary people, including listeners to this program, who don't need this stuff explained to them because they're living it, and they can explain it better than anybody, the hardships that they go through. If they think they've had it hard up to now, well, who was the guy who said, you ain't seen nothing yet? Oh, some well-known person said it.
That's austerity, the solution, and that's what's coming with a vengeance. They've been dabbling with it around the edges here in the U.S., you know, with the debt ceiling, $1 trillion, $2.2 trillion with you know, the delayed effects. But they haven't confronted it head on. They are going to confront it head on right within a week. Watch. Within a week of the November elections, they're going to try to push this thing through with major changes within a few months following the elections. The other foot is going to fall. And that foot will be mostly entitlement cuts. Okay? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other spending. And raising taxes on the middle class is going to be part of it. And reducing taxes on corporations and the very wealthy is going to be another part of it. See, they believe, their argument is, austerity is necessary because austerity will improve business confidence. In other words, if you cut enough, what it will do will be to send a signal to business that, okay, we don't have any deficits anymore. Now we, business, will start investing in the U.S. We'll release our $2.5 trillion cash hoard, and magically now we'll start creating jobs and business in the U.S. Not going to happen. Business, big businesses, where this $2.5 trillion is really accumulated, are addicted now to offshore investments, are addicted to speculative financial investments, and are addicted to returning this money, as I had predicted, to stockholders in the form of dividends and stock buybacks. That's where this money is going. Stock buybacks, dividends, global speculative investments, and offshore investments. So the whole idea of, we're going to restore business confidence and they're going to reinvest is a fiction. They're not going to reinvest in the United States.
It's sort of a version of 1980s trickle down, Jack. Trickle down my foot.
It's not trickle down, it's drip, drip.
It's drip,
drip. It's like an old faucet that leaks, a drip here every second or two. What was a trickle, a little stream, is now a drip, drip. And they're going to cut off the drip, drip, too, here in 2013. They're going to take back some of the water that dripped down, you see. If you want to continue with your metaphor, good metaphor. But you got to understand, austerity programs are really about one thing, and that is we have deficits and debt because of the bailouts in our tax program, right, that have accumulated in wars and healthcare spending and all this has created these deficits and debts at all levels. How are we going to deal with those deficits and debt? Well, don't touch my tax cuts is the first, most important thing. You see, the conservatives and Republicans are all for deficit cutting and debt cutting, not because they are against deficits and debts primarily. The first reason is we don't want to raise our taxes to pay for them. That's why the super committee thing broke down. Republicans and conservatives refused to raise one penny of tax in order to deal with the deficit. The Democrats said, look, and Obama said, look, we'll cut Social Security and Medicare by $600 billion if you guys will agree to a few token loophole closings on the taxes. The Republicans still said no. Well, the Democrats weren't going to go ahead and cut their own throat before an election by, unilaterally cutting Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid by $600 billion, but that's what they offered. They were offering that throughout all of last year, as my book chapter just on the whole deficit-cutting debate shows. They're ready to cut Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Democrats are. But they're not going to do it unilaterally. They need something to show for it, tax increases. But Republicans don't want to do tax increases at all. So for them, the number one objective is protect the Bush tax cuts, which cost about $250 billion a year. Those tax cuts has cost us about $3.4 trillion over the last 10 years. $3.4 trillion, right? Now, they're all talking about, we need to cut $4 trillion. Well, just get rid of the Bush tax cuts, and you solved your problem. End the wars, get rid of the Bush tax cuts, and there's your $4 trillion. But no, they don't want to do that. You see, that's the real issue, the Bush tax cuts. They want to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security instead of the Bush tax cuts. That's what the real fight's all about.
Oh, there's no question, Jack. In the 1930s, when Social Security passed, the Republicans were just livid at the idea of giving people a retirement amount of money. Back in the 1930s, I think that the initial payment started off at something like maybe about $12 a month. Of course, cost of living was a lot cheaper there. But then again, in the 1960s, the Republicans again were livid at the idea of giving medical care to retirees and disabled people. So they literally have been salivating for decades to get rid of these programs, turn everything over to the private sector, and let them rape people for as much in the way of profits as they can get, and give them as little in the way of services, steal as much money as possible. That's the definition of privatization, when big corporations, oligopolies, monopolies, get their hands on things. It's got nothing to do with capitalism, the kind that I was involved in, Jack, in my small family business with others. We simply didn't operate that way. I don't think we even understood how to operate the way the giants do it. We actually ran an honest ship. We thought that doing right by people would pay dividends and happy customers and give us more business, and for us it seemed to work. Not today. Not the way the big boys do their stuff.
Well, you mentioned privatization. Let me give you a parallel here, right? Over the last 30 years since Reagan, we've destroyed the private pension system, the employer-provided pension system, the defined benefit pension, the real pension.
Absolutely.
We destroyed them by creating in parallel the 401ks.
Exactly.
Which are called a defined contribution. In other words, in a defined benefit real pension, the employer has to pay so much per year of service, you know, and is liable for that no matter what. Well, they didn't like that idea as the labor force began to age in the 80s and 90s. They liked it back in the 50s when the labor force was young and no one's retiring. But they didn't like it by the time Reagan came along. So they introduced 401ks, which is just, we're going to put some money in your 401k. You know, you do whatever you want with it. If you lose it, I got no problem. Me, Mr. Corporation, you know, tough luck. Starve when you retire. Okay, that totally undermined it. When you created the parallel pension system called the private defined contribution 401ks, when you created that, it started undermining the regular true pension system. And today, you know, we just have vestiges of real pensions, mostly in the public sector left and in Congress. The rest of us have these 401ks that are, on average, only have $18,000 in them. And even if you're near retirement, $50,000, well, no one's going to be able to afford retirement, you know, with 401ks. But that destroyed the private pension system. Now, fast forward. Paul Ryan, his budget last year and this year to destroy Medicare. How is he going to do it? The same way they destroyed pensions. Medicare is a defined benefit. You're going to get so much, right? You retire. The whole idea is to introduce a defined contribution alternative, you know, a fox in the hen house here, right? And let people go and choose, instead of Medicare, give them a subsidy at first to buy health insurance when you retire at 65, see? And once you get that established, like the 401ks, it will erode and undermine the real Medicare system and phase it out over the course of several decades, just as the real pension systems got phased out over the decades. That's the strategy that Ryan and the conservatives and even some Democrats now have signed on, like this guy from Oregon, Wyden, signed on with the, you know, give them nice left cover here. And that's where they're going with Medicare. They're going to try to prevent it, eliminate it for the young, cut it off, and get people into private insurance approaches, and let it atrophy for the rest of those who have already retired. That's how you kill it over a long term, just like you killed the pension system. They're going to kill Medicare, try it the same way. And once they deal with Medicare, then they move on to Social Security retirement benefits, you see. Bush made a mistake of trying to take on Social Security direct, and he couldn't do it. Now they're going after Social Security through the back door of Medicare. And once they get that, they'll go after Social Security as well.
They want everything, Jack. I mean, they literally want to pick our pockets dry. And as far as they're concerned, you know, I mean, dump us in the street, dump us anywhere. As long as the big boys make money and their stocks go up, and the people in Washington get insider tips and they profit along with them, plus bribes so they get reelected all the time. That's all they care about. And all the big boys care about is just making profits and more of them. And the more they can exploit us, the better their profits. Jack, it's a sick, corrupted system we have to change. I look forward to getting you back next month, and we will really, really go into your book that I am eager to discuss in more detail.
I look forward to discussing the book next time.
Thank you, Jack. And again, join us, of course, every Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Another great guest, another great program tomorrow. Absolutely make it a regular habit.